headlines. Iran's leader emphasizes the importance of strong voter turnout in elections for the sake of effective governance. The Hamas chief says the U.S. and the Israeli regime will not gain through politics what they have failed to achieve through war. The U.S.-Israeli genocidal war in Gaza continues for the 145th day, with the death toll nearing 30,000. Well, welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says a strong election, marked by a huge turnout of zealous voters, is one of the pillars of running the country properly. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei made the remark while meeting with first-time voters and martyrs' families. He said that if people show the world that they are present in important and determining events across the nation, they will save the country and help it move forward. He said that everyone should consider the elections in terms of national interest. The leader added voter apathy would not benefit anyone. It rather would deal a blow to everyone. He said refusing to vote would not solve any of the country's problems. The leader made the remarks ahead of parliamentary and the Assembly of Experts elections set to take place on Friday. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Hakimi Sagheberia is an academic and political analyst joining us from Tehran. We also have Sam Mahdi Torabi, director of the Resalat Strategic Studies Institute, also joining us from Tehran. Welcome to you both. Let me turn to Sam Mahdi Torabi. Sam Mahdi Torabi, taking a look at the elections in the Islamic Republic, it seems like the international news organizations, if you can call them that in a sense, are in overdrive in trying to discredit Iran and the Iranians in terms of trying to discourage them from going to the polls. Why do you think that they are trying so hard to do that?
You know, we're not surprised. Nothing new. And the reason is because the Iranian people, when they vote, they not only are able to take the destiny of their own country into their own hands, but they actually affect the world when they vote. And what I mean by that, elections in Iran actually matter. They are not like the elections in the U.S., where it's basically billionaires sponsoring, you know, two sides to represent their interests, a Zionist paying both sides to represent their interests. It's actually relevant and has a real effect on the lives of the people, not only in Iran, but in the world. And just as an example, we have 3,000 over 3,500 candidates for the 30 seats that the seats for the Tehran that Tehran has in the Majlis in the Iranian parliament, and they come from very diverse backgrounds. Obviously, no country and no nation is going to allow somebody to run in an election that doesn't agree with the basic constitution and law of the country. And so when Iran does that, like every other country, this is taken as an excuse or as a quote-unquote reason to say that, you know, the elections are not fair, which is a complete lie and a complete distortion of what the reality is. Why does it affect the world? Well, let's just look at history. We had the elections that brought about the two Rouhani administrations. That administration accelerated the previously started negotiations with the United States, which ended up in the JCPOA, which was an important matter as it relates to international law and had an effect on the way in which the whole situation as regards the Iranian nuclear file was handled, for example, in the UN. And basically showed the world when the U.S. didn't live up to the agreement, as was predicted by many people in Iran, showed that basically making an agreement with the U.S. and the Europeans is not really that, you know, important because they never live up to it. If we look at the administration that followed when the people voted, the Raisi administration, which is the current administration, it accelerated Iran's entry into the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and into the BRICS organization, and many people, many historians, and many analysts of contemporary global affairs have put this as the date in which the new multipolar world was reflected in its institutions. So prior to that, prior to Iran's entry, we had BRICS, we had China, Russia, Brazil, India, being in BRICS, beginning that process, but with the entry of Iran, which was based on the vote of the people voting for an administration that made this one of its main issues in terms of you know, giving the people in Iran the choice whether they want this or another approach, which was followed by the former administration, which was trying to reach some sort of détente with the West. The people voted for this path. So internationally, globally, and domestically, the vote that we have in Iran is extremely important. And contrary to a lot of countries in the West and so-called liberal democracies, it actually has an effect. And it's not simply a game played by elites and moneyed interests and billionaires. And is not simply a facade for their continued rule in their countries.
Okay, Ms. Hakimiyasava Iberia. The statements made by Iran's leader is very telling in terms of just the plain logic of it. And one of the things that he has said is that for the people who are not voting and discouraging others from not going to the polls will hurt themselves. Can you elaborate a little bit more as to the logic that Iran's leader has used for people who either are undecided, maybe, or are reluctant to go to vote, and the effectiveness of it?
Yeah, I think people have to realize that this is a historic. This is something that they are. Their action is significant. Their action has a meaning for Iran's future. Because we are living at a very specific, at a very significant juncture of time, we are living at a time when basically the global order is reversing, and we are entering an era where Asian countries, including Iran, are going to have an opportunity to build a better future for themselves. And this is at this very juncture of time that we see imperialist powers, especially the Zino-American front, the Zionist regime and the American regime, are actually entering a hyper-imperialist era, a very militaristic way of blocking the will of people around the world. Look at how they are basically dealing with the will of people in every corner of the world, you know, where they are raising their voice against what is happening in Gaza, and there is no one, on the hyper-imperialist front paying attention to them. And the same thing is happening in Iran, that they are trying to, we have to realize that there are these two fronts are real. These are not imagined fronts. We have a front that wants an independent, strong Iran, and of course, Ayatollah Khamenei is leading that front. And have another front on that to happen. It does not want an independent, strong Iran to basically lead the people, not only the Iranian people, but also the people of the region, and maybe even playing a role in the world, in the whole global south, basically, leading different countries that are tired of this, system that is working against the will of the people everywhere. So that is one thing that we have to realize. This is very important. And that is why you see that the leader of the Islamic Revolution, as he is looking at this from that higher, point of view. He's looking at it with this bigger picture in mind. It's not that he's sitting in this room of Iran and he's just looking at the scramble of people who are trying to basically be in the parliament or not, but he's actually looking at the past of Iran, what Iran has basically put behind it, and he's looking at what is ahead of Iran. And that is actually the role that the leader of the Islamic Revolution has to play. That role had been played by Imam Khomeini, and it is being played by Ayatollah Khamenei at the time. If you look at the history of how the leaders of the Islamic Revolution have dealt with the vote of the people, this is how they have dealt with it. They have never said vote this way or the other. Basically, there is a sort of calm in their voice that it seems that they are not even worried about which faction is going to basically come to the power, but they are telling the people, come and take the responsibility that is on your shoulder, come and determine your own, destiny by your own hands. Look at the bigger picture. Look at the way Iran has come. Look at the way ahead, and make a decision. That this is not a time to sit at home and not vote. It is a time to come and do what is right for the country. So I think that is something that we have to also look at. That over the history of the Islamic Revolution, we have not had one occasion in which Imam Khomeini, did not basically support the vote that the people had given. In every occasion, even when later on we came to know that Imam Khomeini had not voted for this person or that person or this faction or that faction, he had supported the vote of the people, the will of the people, because this is an institution that has to be there, the very institution of elections, which is there based on an Islamic point of view. It's not an imitation of Western democracy, but it is something that has been, taken from the Islamic perspective. The will of the people has to be there, and of course, within that framework of, the Islamic criteria that are there for the people who are going to be candidates for taking office. But of course, on the other front, everyone can participate in basically how the country is going to be run on the part of the parliament. And of course, the parliament is a very key organization, a very key institution in the political system of the Islamic Republic.
All right. Thank you very much for that. Hakimi Saleh Birya, academic and political analyst. Also, Sam Mahdi Torabi, director of the Rasalat Strategic Studies Institute. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this news review. The political bureau chief of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says the Israeli regime and the U.S. cannot achieve through politics what they have failed to achieve through war. Addressing a conference in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, by video conferencing, Ismail Haniyeh added the Tel Aviv regime keeps committing the most heinous crimes against Palestinians. He said residents of Gaza are being killed, starved, and displaced by Israeli forces. Haniyeh also highlighted the Israeli attacks on hospitals and humanitarian groups. He further lashed out at the U.S. for its complicity in Israeli crimes. However, he underlined that the resistance front will continue to stand firm against Israel's acts of aggression until the occupied territories are liberated. He further praised Palestinians for their resistance against the Israeli occupation. The Israeli massacre of Palestinians in Gaza keeps unfolding as the regime pounds the blockaded territory with airstrikes and artillery fire. In the latest strikes, the regime bombed a residential building in Deir al-Balah, central Gaza Strip, killing at least two children. A similar strike in that area also left a woman dead and many others injured. The regime also fired artillery shells towards areas in southern and central Gaza Strip. The overall death toll now stands at nearly 30,000 since the onslaught began on October 7. Over 70,300 others have been injured. Muti Abu Musaba joined us earlier from Deir al-Balah, central Gaza Strip, to give us details on the humanitarian situation in the besieged territory.
With the Israeli occupation forces over the last couple of moments actually targeted four residential buildings in Nusayrat refugee camp. Those buildings were completely flattened by the Israeli airstrikes. Scores of the Palestinian casualties actually were reported, and the final number is still unclear as dozens are still trapped and missing under the rubble of those houses. It's worth mentioning that over the last couple of hours, the Israeli artillery intensified its attacks against the northern part of Al-Nusayrat refugee camp, while in Deir al-Balah city here, the southern part of Deir al-Balah city was subjected to heavy bombardment of the Israeli artillery. We are talking about continuous air strikes covering the eastern parts and the western parts of Khan Yunis city, where a big fire actually broke out in one building of the Nasser Medical Complex after the Israeli artillery intensified their attacks on the western part of Khan Yunis city. However, in Rafah city, the eastern parts were subjected to heavy bombardments of the Israeli artillery. Where in Gaza city, as you know, that the Israeli occupation forces are still attacking Al-Zaytun neighborhood, leaving more Palestinian, civilians killed and injured. Regarding the humanitarian conditions, the catastrophic humanitarian conditions the people are living here in the Gaza Strip, particularly in Gaza City and the northern part of Gaza Strip. The Director General of Kamal Adwan Hospital announced that Kamal Adwan Hospital will be out of service by tomorrow, as the Israeli occupation forces are still denying them the fuel needed to operate the generators.
The dire living conditions of displaced Palestinians in the southern Gaza city of Rafah have reached a critical point. Access to basic necessities such as food and water has become an extreme challenge amid Israel's recent threat to launch a ground operation in Rafah. Let's take a listen to what people in Rafah had to say about their situation.
We queue up for water and bread. We queue up for everything. What do we do? I have children who need diapers, and the cost for each child is around $8.2 per day. If they want to enter Rafah, welcome.
As you can see, getting food, water, and medicine is an extreme challenge. To get medicine, I've embarked on a very long walk, a quest for sustenance. Accessing medicine and the essentials of life has become exceedingly difficult. We pray to Allah for relief in these matters. Truly, the situation is incredibly tough, and we hope, Allah willing, for peace and safety for everyone across all the cities of the Gaza Strip. May Allah protect us from the horrors of war. About 1.5 million of us are affected, but where to go? What to do? These questions still haunt me. I try to forget, but every time I think about it, I try to erase it from my mind, hoping that things might change and improve for the better, Allah willing.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. The United Nations Aid Coordinator for the Gaza Strip says no organization could ever replace the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, because of its tremendous capacity in handling the situation in the besieged Palestinian territory. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The English website of Al Mayadeen Television Network has covered this story and tells us more. Dennis Francis, the President of the United Nations General Assembly, has called for UN member states to provide sustainable and predictable financial and political support to UNRWA. The United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees operating in the Gaza Strip. Dennis Francis, responding to a letter from UNRWA Commissioner General Philip Lazzarini, said UNRWA has been an indispensable lifeline for millions of Palestinians. UNRWA, which provides healthcare, education and other vital services to the Palestinian people, currently struggles to address the biggest humanitarian crisis since its establishment. The agency was accused by the Israeli regime last month of having links to the 7th of October operation launched by the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas against the Israeli regime. The regime's allegations against UNRWA, which were not publicly backed by evidence, have prompted more than 10 donor countries, including the United States, Germany, the European Union, Canada, Japan, to suspend their financial support for UNRWA. The funding from these countries makes up the bulk of all the funding received by the UN agency. UNRWA said being cut off in this way means the agency will run out of money altogether within a matter of weeks. A US intelligence assessment recently cast doubt on Israel's accusations against UNRWA, citing the regime's bias against the United Nations agency. The National Intelligence Council report, released recently, assessed with low confidence that a handful of UNRWA staffers had taken part in the October 7th operation launched by the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas against the Israeli regime. The four-page intelligence report indicated that the National Intelligence Council could not independently confirm the Israeli allegations. Separately, the United Nations agency, in a post on X, said shelters in the besieged coastal region were severely overcrowded. UNRWA said clean water is scarce in Gaza, solid waste is accumulating, spread of diseases is on the rise. The situation is catastrophic, but UNRWA teams continue working to provide critical aid to the people of Gaza. A two-month-old Palestinian baby has died from starvation in northern Gaza Strip, according to media reports, as the Israeli regime is charged with using starvation as a weapon of war. The developments come amid reports that people in Gaza have been facing a humanitarian crisis and starvation, as Israel has continued its relentless bombardment and blocked delivery of much-needed humanitarian aid to the besieged territory. United Nations website UN.org has also covered the same story and tells us more. The United Nations Aid Coordinator for the Gaza Strip says no organization could ever replace the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees, known as UNRWA, because of its tremendous capacity in handling the situation in the besieged Palestinian territory. Sigrid Karg said recently, there is no way that any organization can replace or substitute UNRWA because of its tremendous capacity, the fabric of UNRWA, their ability and their knowledge of the population in Gaza. Several Western countries, not least the United States of America and Britain, have suspended their funding of UNRWA following unproven allegations by the Israeli regime that some of UNRWA staff were involved in Operation Al-Aqsa Storm on 7th of October last year. Norway, one of the few major donors, has urged fellow donor countries to reflect on the wider consequences of cutting off aid to UNRWA. The people in Gaza are already suffering from lack of food, lack of water, and basic supplies. Also recently, the United Nations warned of a humanitarian collapse in the Gaza Strip in the wake of the funding cuts to UNRWA. In a joint statement, the heads of organizations that form the United Nations Interagency Standing Committee said the halt in funding was perilous. They said withdrawing funds from UNRWA is perilous and would result in the collapse of the humanitarian system in the Gaza Strip, with far-reaching humanitarian and human rights consequences in the occupied Palestinian territories and across the region. And recently, the political bureau chief of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, said the funding cuts to UNRWA go against an interim ruling by the International Court of Justice on 26th of January to increase humanitarian assistance to the Gaza Strip. Britain's former ambassador to Uzbekistan, Craig Murray, recently said the defunding of UNRWA is a reaction to the International Court of Justice's ruling against the Israeli regime. The Palestinian Prime Minister, Mohammad Shatir, of the Palestinian Authority, has charged the Israeli regime with a premeditated political attack on UNRWA and called for restoration of aid and funding to the United Nations agency. Iran's Press TV has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Islamic Republic of Iran has once again denounced a bitter move by certain Western countries in suspending the funds to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, the main lifeline for Palestinian refugees in the Gaza Strip and in the occupied Palestinian territories. In a post on his X account recently, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said it is a painful irony that those countries who have cut off their aid to UNRWA following unfounded allegations levelled by the Israeli regime are now widely charged with genocide in Gaza. Kanani said the awakened conscience of the world will judge the decision that those countries made at a time when the Palestinians are going through terribly tough circumstances. Nasser Kanani said, the Israeli regime prevents the delivery of humanitarian aid to the Palestinians of Gaza, and this stands contrary to the UN Security Council resolution and an interim ruling by the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, at The Hague, Netherlands. Nasser Kanani also criticized the hollow expressions of concern by a number of countries about the genocidal campaign in Gaza and their lack of will to limit diplomatic relations with the Israeli regime. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said some of these countries are even providing the Israeli regime with military assistance. In a joint statement, 28 aid agencies and non-governmental organizations have voiced deep concern over the decision by the United States, Britain, and a number of other countries to cut off funding to UNRWA. The statement said, the suspension of funding by donor countries will impact life-saving assistance for over 2 million civilians in the Gaza Strip, over half of whom are children who rely on aid by UNRWA.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
So dear brothers and sisters in Islam, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Now, when it comes to our responsibility towards the Ahlul Bayt, if you and I want to raise our children and make ourselves also ideological warriors for the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, it's not something that is achieved by just making one trite prayer. Rather, there's heavy lifting involved. It's not easy to raise a child who will be a soldier of the Imam of the time. One of the things that it entails is that you and I introduce the Ahlul Bayt as they are. We have to introduce the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam as they are. So what we believe about this Imam, Imam al-Askari, is that he is loftier in station, him and all of the members of the Prophet's family, that they are loftier in station than any of Allah's anbiya, meaning Allah's great prophets, his noble prophets. And you and I, again, we have no idea how wonderful they are, how close they are to God. We hear stories about Nabi Nuh. But what was it like? How close was he to God that God gave him that ark? We have no idea. The station of Nabi Musa, Kalimullah, he spoke to God, communion with God. Again, we have no idea how wonderful the station of Nabi Musa. Same goes for Nabi Isa, born without a father, curing the blind, the leper. All of these great prophets, we have no idea of their station. What we do say is this: as great as they were, and we humans have no way of fathoming how great they were not like Ahlul Bayt. They weren't at the same status as Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. Our prophets used to ask God to be with and to join Ahlul Bayt. I want to mention two stories, again, just for us to understand a little bit about the station of Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, and the station of our own Imam, Imam al-Askari. So, Nabi Yusuf, in the Quran, after he achieves the final victory, after he has now been reunited with his brothers, he's over there, he's been established in the land, at that stage, he asks God for some beautiful du'as. One of them, in Surah Yusuf, this is verse number 101, 12-101, Yusuf says, وَأَلْحِقْنِي بِالصَّالِحِينَ, God, make me join those righteous, the صالحين. Make me join them. In the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala doesn't provide a response to his dua. There's another prophet, Nabi Ibrahim, exact same dua, وَأَلْحِقْنِي بِالصَّالِحِينَ. For Nabi Ibrahim, who you and I remember, was made an imam. He was made an imam. For him also, when he made this dua, what does God tell him? This is now in Surah Baqarah 130. God says this: he did get that request answered in the hereafter. It says, وَلَقَدْ أَسْتَفَيْنَاهُ فِي الدُّنْيَا. Yes, we chose him in this world. وَإِنَّهُ فِي الْآخِرَةِ, in the akhirah, مِنَ الصَّالِحِينَ. He did, was able to join Ahlul Bayt. The Ahlul Bayt is something else. No Nabi, excluding our Prophet, is at their station. They were excluded from, or exempted from prostrating before Adam. In the Quran, Allah has a conversation. Shaitan speaks to God. God tells him to prostrate before Adam. He rejects God. When he rejects God, God says, why? And he says these words. God is now speaking to him. This is Surah Sa'd, Surah 38, verse number 75. Astakbarta? Is it that you were arrogant? Am kunta min al-aleen? Or is it that no, actually you're one of the exalted ones? The exalted ones were exempted. Are you one of the aleen? Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam were created 2,000 years before Adam. It is through their worship that the Malaika learned to worship. So, again, no comparison to them, and this position that we have, that the Ahlul Bayt are higher in station than even the Anbiya, is something which is supported by the Ahadith, the Sunnah of our Prophet. Once, Marhum Ayatullah Fatimiyah, Marhum, was asked a question. He was in Ashfiya, and one of our Sunni brothers approached him, and he said, is it true that you believe the station of the Ahlul Bayt is loftier than that, even of the great Anbiya? He said, but we all believe that. It's not just us who believe that. We all believe that. And he quoted a hadith, reliable hadith, from the books of our Sunni brothers, Our Prophet is speaking. Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. He says, our Prophet speaking, Atani malakun. An angel came to me. Faqala ya Muhammad. He spoke to me. He said, O Muhammad, Salman arsalna qablaka min rusulina ala ma bu'ithu. Ask those prophets who were sent before you, what was the condition for them embracing this mission? There was a condition. There was something they had to embrace before they were allowed to be sent by God. What was that condition? The Prophet asked what the condition was. Qultu ala ma bu'ithu. What was the condition they were sent on? And the angel responded, Qal ala wilayatika wa wilayati Ali ibn Abi Talib. The condition for them becoming anbiya, prophets, was that they embrace your wilaya and the wilaya of Ali ibn Abi Talib. Now, that's one part of our mission, reading Ziyarah Jami'ah, which has been recommended by the 12th Imam. There's another job that we had. I mentioned that being and raising the generation of the soldiers of the Imam is not an easy task. There is heavy lifting involved. One part that we also have to do is to introduce the contributions of the Ahlul Bayt. The strategy of the Ahlul Bayt, the contemporaries of the Ahlul Bayt. Why is it that you and I, now you, and speaking as a mother or as a father, when you're introducing Imam al-Askari, and you want to introduce his jihad, and what he did for us, and how severe the taqiyya was at the time of Imam al-Askari, how the taqiyya of Imam al-Askari, because he's leading the resistance, led to punishing the enemy. You want to be able to explain that? There are some books, and I've recommended one of them before, The Lives of the Twelve. Brothers and sisters, inshallah, if they can read that fourth volume, that would give us some detail. I'd like to introduce a new book for brothers and sisters to also read, and that is this book, which is called Imam Hussein's Brothers in Arms. Imam Hussein's Brothers in Arms. This is another way, I'm telling you, brothers and sisters, if you look at this, you'll have a different appreciation for Imam al-Askari. When you hear what taqiyya is, correct taqiyya, how he applied it, Imam al-Askari. Under what conditions did he struggle? Obviously, the appreciation will be a lot greater. Now.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahim Kareem Adi Alim Halim Hakim Mateen شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the the limelight.
The British Army has come under scrutiny for its inability to hire people at all levels of service. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Telegraph has covered this story and tells us more. A leaked document revealed the British Army wants to relax security checks it runs on overseas recruits in an effort to solve the growing staffing crisis. Understood to be the latest guidance, the internal policy document leaked to the British Daily outlines a series of actions that aim to boost falling personnel numbers and cause security clearance the primary barrier to non-UK personnel gaining a commission in the army. Vetting is a standard part of the process of becoming an officer in the British Army and included counter-terrorism checks. Security clearance is described as being the most common type of vetting process and determines that a person's character and personal circumstances are such that they can be trusted to work in a position that involves long-term, frequent, and uncontrolled access to secret assets. The 5-year period being a UK resident needed to gain security clearance was described as prohibitive to overseas recruits applying for officer and intelligence roles. The leaked document noted that the Army struggles to attract talent from ethnic minority backgrounds into the officer corps. It said that while people from Commonwealth countries can serve in the British Army, just 135 officers from overseas are currently serving in the British Armed Forces. Of these, just 28 are recorded as being from ethnic minority backgrounds, while the rest are white Irish or white Commonwealth. A group of former army officials have since signed a letter to the UK's Defence Minister, Grant Shapps, calling the updated policy dangerous madness. The army has come under scrutiny for its inability to hire people at all levels of service. Outsourcing giant Capita, which is in charge of recruitment for the army, recommended that it should ditch or loosen restrictions on hiring soldiers with tattoos and those with a history of asthma to solve its recruitment crisis. The firm told the Defence Select Committee inquiry into the recruitment of youngsters that many were waiting 150 days to join the army, partly caused by the medical assessments they have to undertake. Its representatives told MPs that would-be recruits were being attracted elsewhere as the time taken to be accepted was so long that they were finding other jobs in the meantime, amid ominous warnings that the Army, Navy and Marines are all hemorrhaging troops faster than they can be recruited. A top US general also warned that the UK's shrinking army is not what it used to be. A former senior US general has said that while the United Kingdom was still seen as America's closest ally, it was also seen as having diminished capabilities over the past couple of decades. They added, "Hence, while being the most important ally across the board, it is decidedly not what it used to be, regrettably. Based on the current trends, the Army will have just 52,000 troops in 10 years' time." In a 1-year period up to September of last year, the Army's strength plummeted from 79,139 to 75,983, as more soldiers left than started. The website The Defense Post has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to government figures, almost 30,000 British troops from across the armed forces are medically unfit for combat operations due to physical injuries and mental health issues. The problem is greatest in the army, where only 53,000 troops out of a total of around 75,000 personnel are currently fully fit for frontline operations. That means that 30% of all troops in the army, or 3 in 10 soldiers, would not be fully fit to fight in a conflict now. The injury crisis will heap further pressure on the new Defence Secretary Grant Shapps, following the disclosure that all 3 services are significantly under strength. According to numbers released by the Ministry of Defence, the MOD, overall 28,664 personnel across all 3 of the armed forces are currently not fully fit for combat. While some of those could deploy overseas in an emergency as part of a large force, many would not be able to take part in combat missions or even leave a secure base because they have been medically downgraded. Recently, the Defence Post revealed the recruitment crisis is forcing the Royal Navy to decommission 2 warships, Westminster and Argyll, so that the new class of Type 26 frigates can be staffed. According to the Ministry of Defence, the Army is currently composed of around 74,110 personnel, but only 53,192 are fit for operations, or what the military calls medically fully deployable. A Freedom of Information document obtained by this newspaper reveals that 9,217 soldiers are classified as medically limited deployable, meaning that they can deploy on operations but will only be able to conduct certain duties. A further 7,449, almost 1 in 10 of all soldiers, cannot be deployed at all and are classified as medically non-deployable. Comparisons with the number of injured troops from July of 2021 appear to show that the problem is getting worse. In July of 2021, there were 13,248 troops across the armed forces classified as non-deployable. But by July of 2023, the latest figures available show that the number had grown to 14,743. A further 7,921 personnel were classed as being of limited deployability. The classification means that they have either a persistent but relatively minor injury, such as a back problem, or an injury that is close to recovery, such as ligament damage. According to government figures, there are 29,220 personnel serving in the Royal Navy and Royal Marines, while a further 29,010 personnel serving in the Royal Air Force. But Ministry of Defence figures show that there are currently just 21,649 fully fit sailors in the Navy, while the Royal Air Force has just 19,466 fit personnel. The Freedom of Information request reveals that across the armed forces, 13,727 troops have been downgraded from frontline duties because of musculoskeletal injuries suffered in training or from combat. But the document also shows 4,214 troops cannot deploy on combat operations because of mental health problems. Meanwhile, the number of troops being treated for orthopedic and spinal injuries under the National Health Service Fast Track Surgery contract has more than doubled in the last 4 years. In 2020-2021, 203 were treated under the scheme. But in 2023-2024, the Ministry of Defence predicts up to 540 personnel will receive fast-track treatment. The recruitment crisis facing the armed forces led Grant Shapps to decide to mothball the amphibious assault ships Albion and Bulwark. It has since emerged that the Royal Marines are currently 600 troops short of their target figure, and the Army and the Royal Navy are also short of personnel, amid claims that the so-called Generation Z is unwilling to join up. According to new figures, Army recruitment has been below target every year for more than a decade. Data uncovered by Labour Party shows that the recruiters signed up 5,560 regular soldiers last year, when their target was 8,220, leaving a gap of 2,660 personnel. In the worst performing year of 2018-2019, there was a deficit of 4,130 troops, with 5,860 soldiers recruited when the army needed as much as 9,990 soldiers. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
On the occasion of the 40th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, February 11th, 2019, economy is a key defining point. A strong economy is the strong point and the important factor in blocking domination and infiltration, while a weak economy is the Achilles heel that prepares the ground for infiltration, domination, and intrusion by the enemies. Poverty and affluence affect the materialistic and spiritual aspects of human beings. Economy, of course, is not an ideal of the Islamic society. Rather, it is a means without which one would not be able to fulfill the ideals. Insistence on reinforcing the country's independent economy that is based on mass and quality production, justice-based distribution, reasonable and waste-free consumption, and wise managerial relations, which I have repeatedly insisted upon time and again in recent years, are due to the incredible impact economy can have on the society's current and future life. The Islamic Revolution showed us the way out of the weak, dependent, and corrupt economy of the Pahlavi era. However, feeble performances have posed internal and external challenges to the country's economy.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The external challenges include the enemy sanctions and temptations that will be rendered less effective or even ineffective if the internal challenges are resolved. The internal challenges consist of structural defects and managerial weaknesses. The main defects include economic reliance on oil, government interference in sectors of the economy that do not fit into the sphere of government's responsibilities, relying on imports rather than domestic strength and potentials, very limited exploitation of the country's human resources potentials, defective and unbalanced budgeting, and finally, lack of consistency in executive economic policies, disrespecting priorities, and excessive and even wasteful expenses in parts of state organizations. The result is problems in people's livelihoods, including the high rate of unemployment among the youth, low income of lower classes, etc.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.